Thank you, Michael. First of all, I would like to thank the directors of the Afro-American Lecture Series for inviting me here tonight, but taking cognizance of the fact that we are still basking in the glow of Negro History Week, I would also like to thank a few soul brothers who helped make this appearance possible. Their names would be Frederick Douglass, Benjamin Banneker, County Cullen, Blue-Eyed Soul Brother John Brown, and even old Uncle Booker T. Washington. Of course, there are others, white as well as black, and all of them trying to do the same thing, and that is to help the black man attain his freedom. Help the black man gain the respect that is usually granted to others at birth by virtue of their white skin. But today, most of the youth aren't worried about whether Booker T. Washington was an Uncle Tom, or whether Marcus Garvey was off his rocker by wanting all Negroes to go back to Africa, or even whether old honest Abe Lincoln was as honest as some history books would have us believe him to be. That's not exactly ancient history, but is it relevant? That seems to be the watchword today, relevancy. I declare that it is. The history of Lincoln and Garvey and Booker T. Washington was part of an America that we really are just beginning to know. And it is a history that no one can escape, be he white or be he black, because it has terrible relevance to what is taking place today. The days of Lincoln constituted a peculiar time, and it fostered a peculiar institution. And out of that peculiar institution, the black struggle for identity really began. The most important word to remember is not struggle or even black, but identity. The black man will never be able to escape his blackness. And that is why the pressed hair, the conch or the gas head, however it's called, the phony blonde wig sitting atop the straightened curls, the accumulation of artifacts such as fine cars and fine shoes, that is why these things have failed so miserably in the past to enable the black man to throw off his ever-conscious feeling of inferiority. No matter how much he acquires or how straight his hair becomes, he needed only to walk into a certain atmosphere, a neighborhood, a white neighborhood, if you will, to quickly be shocked back into the full realization that he is indeed a black man. And a little bit more, or a little bit less besides. You hear the word identity over and over again. Alienated from the world to which he is born, and from the country of which he is a citizen, the black man yet is surrounded by the successful values of the world. But how can he define himself? You hear such terms as identity crisis, self-identity, or even sexual identity. And these terms are thrown into the academic field of battle in social roles as personal traits or conscious self-images. But let us look at what William James wrote about identity, or rather, a sense of identity. James wrote that a man's character is discernible in the mental or moral attitude in which he felt himself most deeply and intensely active and alive. I'm going to repeat that. James wrote that a man's character is discernible in the mental or moral attitude in which he felt himself most deeply and intensely active and alive. At such moments, James continues, there is a voice inside which speaks and says, "This is the real me." Such experience always includes an element of tension, active tension, of holding his own and trusting outward things to perform their part so as to make it a full harmony, but without any guarantee that they will. How many of us have felt this way? How many of us have felt that we really are somebody? If we're athletes, we get this active tension on the playing field when we've made a good play, or even vicariously as we watch a friend or a teammate succeed. And the same holds true in everyday life, when we feel we're really working up to our potential. But what about the black man? Take the athlete. As soon as he steps off the field of play, he's on another field, a battlefield, not of his making, but foisted upon him by an attitude that is more perplexing to understand than it is to define. In the past, the Negro accepted this bitter pill of reality. It was shoved down his throat, he gave a slight sigh, a small groan, and it settled in his gut. But although he tried, he could never digest it. It was too hard, and it was only a matter of time before he would finally spit it out. You see this terrible retching all around you, the throwing up on campuses throughout the country of a severe discipline imposed on black athletes that they can't swallow. This, too, is part of the black struggle for identity. The efforts of black athletes to be treated not as just cannon fodder for the games, but to be treated as men as well. And don't you know, when they have done this rebelling, they feel a sort of glow, not unlike the active tension that James wrote about. It is hypocritical of whites to think, as some of them do, that black people are pushing too hard for their place in the sun. What would whites do if their rights were threatened? What if they were put in the same bag? Why, some of them might even be fanatical enough to blow up a toilet in the U.S. Capitol. And if enough of them get mad, they might upset a whole Democratic convention in Chicago in 1968. It is incredibly naive to think that black people would be capable of taking this bull they've taken for more than 300 years and accept it with just a song and a dance. I'm sure I don't have to spell out the bull, but let's take a few for instances. Despite the 1954 Supreme Court decision, the public schools are just as segregated as ever. It's worse in the North. Despite the plethora of civil rights laws, blacks are still being denied their full rights of citizenship. And despite the anti-lynching laws of many decades past, blacks are still being cut down in less civilized sections of our country. Go to any part of this great land where blacks make up a large minority, and you will find in the jails they make up a large majority. Presidencies have been won by promises to contain black people. Why? Because there are still many people who believe that blacks are inherently criminal, that they are not trustworthy, that they are less than human. The black man has made great strides in the last 100 years, many would have us believe, and it is true. The black man has achieved much. Yet we have fewer blacks in the Senate today than we had during the period of Reconstruction. And unemployment among blacks, especially among black youth, is two and sometimes three times what it is among whites. Lack of education? Research figures show that uppermost in the minds of black parents is the desire for their children to finish school. Inferiority? Then there would never have been a Frederick Douglass, or a Langston Hughes, or a Malcolm X, or a Martin Luther King, or a Mary McLeod Bethune, or a Harriet Tubman, or a Lorraine Hansberry, all brilliant and all black. It is simply a matter of lack of opportunity, nothing more, a matter of color. Now, before I hear the shouts of America, love it or leave it, let me point out that I am not going anywhere, and neither are black people. Black Americans have shed too much blood on foreign soil, fighting for theirs and someone else's freedom to ever consider leaving this country. This is their home, and most of them have decided that if they're going to die, they might as well die here at home. You know, there must be something tremendously wonderful in the black psyche that allows him to be maligned in service and in civilian life, and yet still keep the faith in the American Judeo-Christian ethic way of doing things. Let me cite two cases that show what a strain this is. A black Chicagoan, 18 or 19 years old, it doesn't matter what age, entered the army and served with distinction in Vietnam. While there, he literally killed himself by diving onto a grenade, saving the lives of four of his buddies, all of whom happened to be white. Chicago named a small park after the young Medal of Honor winner, and even Mayor Daley attended the ceremonies. That same night, vandals visited the park and left behind their messages of racial hatred. The second example concerns Dr. King. Chicago named a street after Dr. King shortly after he was killed in 1968. The street, however, happened to pass through a section of town populated by whites. The second day after the street signs went up bearing Dr. King's name, the street signs in the white section were changed to read Dr. Martin Luther Coon, Jr. Now, I know none of the people in this hall would have any sympathy for people who would do such acts of cowardice. Yet I would ask you to make one simple experiment. What is the image that enters your mind when you think black man? Is it the image of simply another man like yourself, of a person like yourself? Or do you inwardly harbor thoughts that perhaps because he is black and I am white, I am better than he is? Don't try to fool yourself, because only true fools fool themselves, and they very rarely fool blacks. The discovery of dormant racism, especially in the white who has always spoken the liberal tongue, is perhaps one of the most heartbreaking developments to befall blacks in their long struggle for equal opportunity. It is this discovery that has been the chief reason for the sometimes violent change of the once Negro mood to something we might call the black mood. The Negro mood was one of compatibility, of integration. Remember the pictures of the black and white marches together, singing and marching along with our white brothers, marching down Freedom Road. What happened to those pictures? Sure, it was a rocky road, but no one seemed to mind because everybody was in the same bag. Well, the bag has been changed now, and simply because the Negro wanted to do things, the white man obviously thought he was the only one capable of doing them. Negro wanted to lead. He wanted leadership roles. He wanted other Negroes to start telling, yes, even telling the whites what to do. The whites, most of them, felt left out. They felt hurt, and so they quit. They quit donating money, they quit donating their time, and they started talking about Negroes being too militant. At the same time, the Negro was beginning to feel a certain pride of achievement. The sit-ins went well. Not all of them got their heads cracked, and quite naturally, they felt they were ready to move into the forefront of the organizations. After all, wasn't that what whites were there to tell them to do, to help them to do? And then Stokely showed up and yelled something about black power, and the whites were off and running again for cover. The Negroes were shocked. They thought the whites were sincere. They had trusted their white brothers and sisters, and their white brothers and sisters had been found wanting. It was time to find other white brothers and sisters. Please understand, this is not an indictment of all whites in the intermediate phase of the civil rights movement. Rather, it was a fitful time for them. It was something they could not understand. Suddenly being forced to take a back seat to a sassy black buck or a black girl who couldn't even speak the King's English. It was a matter of who was to judge who was running the show. Paternalism dies hard. Mothers and fathers don't like to see their children grow up and strike out for themselves, and often the break is chaotic. But the time soon arrives when the mother and father must look at the child and see that he or she is not a child anymore, that he is grown and perhaps has a few ideas of his own on how things should be run. And that is all the young blacks of today are trying to say, that they have their own ideas about how things are to be done, and also that they are not going to stand for the bull that their elders stood for. Speaking of the young black and their elders brings up another interesting point. The so-called generation gap that is supposed to exist between older and younger whites really does not exist among older and younger blacks. Most of the older blacks are proud of their young bitching brood. They are just habitually accustomed to a style of life that gags them and shackles them, and they are too old to break the bonds. In my opinion, this period, the black awareness bag that we are in today, is perhaps the most important development in the history of black people. It is a period that cries out for trust in one another, for love of brother, and for love of self. You cannot hope for acceptance until you first have come to accept yourself. I, for one, would prefer to have seen this period at the first stage in the so-called civil rights movement. Black awareness has always been a part of the struggle for our identity, but it hovered like an invisible cloud over the periods of the sit-ins and lay-ins and what have you, and only now, when blacks are relying and trusting in other blacks, has it become sharply defined and dramatically exemplified. Strangely enough, had Marcus Garvey concentrated his efforts on making black people feel at home here, rather than attempting to flee to Africa, the history of black people in this country may be entirely different. He had the right idea, but his eyesight was a mite faulty. But nevertheless, the identity struggle has begun in earnest and with some startling results. Black people have begun to think of what is good for themselves, and not merely what a white society judges is good. Black people are emulating white people, to be sure, but they are attempting to put into force the good things rather than the bad. They are learning that it is good to be skeptical of many institutions that they once thought meant them no harm. They don't trust everybody in the Democratic Party anymore. They are beginning to write their own books and enjoy their own looks. And since we have a long way to go before we get out of the era of the Negro first, you know, the first Negro to do this, the first Negro to do that, the firsts are becoming very interesting. The first black recently was named to the board of General Motors, Reverend Leon Sullivan. The first black company recently went public in the stock market, Johnson Products, owned by Johnson, George Johnson of Chicago. These things perhaps might have happened if there had never been a sit-in, or a prayer in, or a long, hot summer, but you'll never make me believe it. The status quo remains status quo without some disruption. It is historical fact. So the black awareness bit has singled in a new spirit in the black man, but it has carried along with it some disheartening side effects. Some of our more boisterous black leaders have chosen to interpret the new mood as made to order for them. They have adopted a chauvinistic stance that presumes black militancy, the fist-waving brand, to be the only answer to the racial dilemma. In this sense, black is not beautiful. It is as ugly as the extremist of any color is ugly when he seeks pain as an end to justify his own shortcomings or his bitterness. It is just stupid to make enemies when you haven't got enough troops to keep track of all the incoming fire. Even worse, these fiery black brothers have alienated and disturbed a lot of other blacks who have chosen to adopt their own style. The fire eaters feel that their way is the only way, and whoever is not with them is their enemy. Such people would call for the assassination of Leroy Wilkins of the NAACP and Whitney Young of the Urban League because they are moderate Negroes, not even worthy to be called black. I think history will judge Mr. Wilkins and Mr. Young otherwise. The people who preach violence rather than program should be denounced for what they are, demagogues, for they do themselves and their people a great wrong. Perhaps another bad side effect of the black awareness period is the manner in which I find many of the Afro-American history courses handled. I don't want to knock the course because it's a long time overdue, but I must confess to certain ambivalence concerning the thrust of such courses. In some schools, I find the blacks trying to keep whites out of black history courses. Black history, more than any history, needs to become the subject of study for all people, for the very simple reason that lack of knowledge of black history has doubtless done more to cause racism than anything else. White people need to learn black history in order to become truly educated about their fellow black brothers and sisters, for through such knowledge comes respect and appreciation. Perhaps there will come a day when there will be no need for black history or Afro-American history. It will be just called American history, not written by one ethnic group or lived by one ethnic group, but written and lived in peace by all Americans. Thank you.